Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And what's it going to take, folks? I mean, I know what we're providing you. The whole point, I'm going to reiterate this, the only path forward for us to succeed, to preserve liberty, and to preserve this great American experiment is to demand compliance to the Constitution and get all of our government into compliance. It's that simple. That's all we got to do. So with that, what we're going to do, we're bringing Paul back. Welcome back, Paul. And as Paul is coming back and probably fiddling with the mute button or whatever, Paul, I wanted to point out that another document that we're going to actually read today, because it's anticipated that, you know, we won't, this one document that we're actually going to read, which is the report of the proceedings in Congress. In other words, what we just read was a report from the Annapolis Committee. And now we're actually going to read the congressional response from Continental Congress. And this is February 21st. Remember, I said that they responded the following year after they got back into session. And so this is their response. And then the we'll go through this. But that does not make a convention make. In other words, this does not actually, you know, close the deal that the convention is going to happen. Each state then had to basically empower these authorizing, you know, acts or what have you, and electing and empowering delegations and so forth. And so as soon as we're done with this, then we're going to dive into the, it's a combined state acts authorizing the election for delegates for the Constitutional Convention, which is the next document we're going to read today. So we'll get into that. We will not be able to finish this because this is a good long document because it's all of the 13 states.
Okay. So this first one, this report of the proceedings is kind of short.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's, you know, probably about 6-7 paragraphs. So anyway, why don't you go ahead? Because at the very front end of this, they kind of talk about, you know, the convention and so forth, and then they have these quotes from the convention, and then they actually send out to the states their guidance. So go ahead.
Okay, here we go. Report of proceedings in Congress, Wednesday, February 21st, 1787. Congress assembled as before. The report of a grand committee consisting of Mr. Dane, Mr. Varnum, Mr. S. M. Mitchell, Mr. Smith, Mr. Cadwallader, Mr. Irwine, Mr. N. Mitchell, Mr. Forrest, Mr. Grayson, Mr. Blunt, Mr. Bull, and Mr. Few, to whom was referred a letter of 14 September 1786 from J. Dickinson, written at the request of commissioners from the states of Virginia, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York, assembled in the city of Annapolis, together with a copy of the report of the said commissioners to the legislatures of the states by whom they were appointed, being an order of the day, was called up, and which was contained in the following resolution, viz. Quote, Congress having had under consideration the letter of John Dickinson, Esquire, chairman of the commissioners who assembled at Annapolis during the last year, also the proceedings of the said commissioners and entirely coinciding with them as to the inefficiency of the federal government and the necessity of devising such further provisions as shall render the same adequate to the exigencies of the Union, do strongly recommend to the different legislatures to send forward delegates to meet the proposed convention on the second Monday in May next at the city of Philadelphia. End quote. The delegates for the state of New York thereupon laid before Congress instructions which they had received from their constituents and in pursuance of the said instructions, moved to postpone the further consideration of the report in order to take up the following proposition, to wit, quote, that it be recommended to the states composing the union that a convention of representatives from the said states respectively be held at on for the purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and perpetual union between the United States of America, and reporting to the United States in Congress assembled and to the states respectively such alterations and amendments of the said Articles of Confederation as the representatives met at such convention shall judge proper and necessary to render them adequate to the preservation and support of the Union.
Okay, and so, then it has okay, signature. So do you understand, because you got these two paragraphs that are highlighted. The first one is the recommendation from the convention in Annapolis. The right. second one is a proposal to postpone and to actually do this, you know, to basically, and what are they asking for in the second one? They're asking, go ahead.
In the second one, they're asking, they don't want to do this here. They're saying, let's have a convention to what?
No. So this is kind of interesting, because if you look at where the anti-conventionites get this concept that there was this constraint upon the commission, or those delegates that were commissioned to go, this is where it came from right there. Because this is what really? They're basically saying. Look what they say here. That
revising the Articles of Confederation.
Yes, for right. revising the Articles of Confederation and perpetual union between the United States of America and reporting to the United States in Congress assembled to the states respectively, such alterations and amendments of the said articles as representatives met in convention shall judge proper and necessary to render them adequate for the preservations. In other words, this is a tone that basically says they're only going to forward recommendations.
Okay.
This is where this idea that they were commissioned to do just that. But when you okay. read the sentence above that, that it basically says, no, that they basically are, you know, calling for them to deal with the inefficiencies of the federal government and the necessity of devising such farther provisions as shall render the same adequate to the exigencies of the union, do strongly recommend the different legislatures send forward delegates to meet the proposed convention. So in other words, that it's not making recommendations, actually making the adequate changes to meet the exigencies.
Okay.
There's a difference in the guidance. Mm-hmm. One from New York being one of the big cabals that said, hey, we don't want to, you know, surrender any of our power. We just, you know, right. throw back at us what you suggest and we'll chew on it.
So this is that's the second highlighted paragraph.
Here, yes, it is. Yeah, that's why it says right here, the paragraph that's preceding that or in between the two highlights, the delegates from the state of New York thereupon laid before Congress instructions which they had received from their constituents in pursuance of the said instructions, the above instructions, moved to postpone the farther consideration of the report in order to take up the following proposition, to wit. So in other words, what was laid before the Continental Congress was, hey, don't move forward with the first. We recommend that we do this and kind of, you know, tiptoe forward instead of really plundering forward and, you know, taking names and, you know, kicking some butt and so forth and getting things done. And so
this was recommended by only one state. Also.
Yes, correct. Okay, so now the following is what actually comes from Continental Congress. Okay, so they actually had this vote, right? There's all these different votes, right?
On the question postponed for the purpose above mentioned, the yeas and nays being required by the delegates. Okay.
So the question was lost. right? So the question was lost, and it goes on. So go ahead and you finish reading these last three paragraphs.
A motion was then made by the delegates from Massachusetts to postpone the further consideration of the report in order to take into consideration a motion which they read in their place. This being agreed to, the motion of the delegates from Massachusetts as taken up and being amended was agreed to as follows. Whereas there is provision in the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union for making alterations therein by the assent of Congress, a Congress of the United States and of the legislatures of the several states, and whereas experience hath evinced that there are defects in the present Confederation, as a mean to remedy which several of the states, and particularly the state of New York, by express instructions to their delegates in Congress, have suggested a convention for the purpose is expressed in the following resolution, and such convention appearing to be the most probable mean of establishing in these states a firm national government, resolved that in the opinion of Congress it is expedient that on the second Monday in May next, a convention of delegates who shall have been appointed by the several states be held in Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and the several legislatures such alterations and provisions therein as shall, when agreed to in Congress and confirmed by the states, render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union.
So how did that jive with what they put in this resolution to what they were looking for in the, you know, this, hey, let's slow this down a little bit from New York.
It almost looks like they combined them. Okay.
But what they maintained is adequate to the exigencies of the government and the preservation of the Union.
Correct.
In other words, they gave them license to do what mm-hmm. they felt necessary.
Okay. So in other words, they included the language from New York, but they also essentially at the end said, do whatever is necessary, you know, to promote the preservation of the Union.
Right. So if you also look, it says propose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and the several state legislatures such alterations therein as we as shall, when agreed in Congress and confirmed by the states, render the Constitution. So what they were really looking for was they wanted to make sure that they had this unanimity, that, you know, it would be unanimous. You got to remember, and we went through the Articles of Confederation just a little while ago, right? Last week. And how much did it really require for the states to actually be able to make changes? How many states was it? Because several times.
Federation.
Yeah, several times. So they actually had amendments to the Articles of Confederation, but they also had this, you know, super minority. If you remember,
it was unanimous.
No, it did require unanimity. There was, as you look at the process above, that it only took 9 states to actually invoke changes.
In the Articles?
Of Confederation, yes. Now, did you miss that?
I did.
Okay, well, that's okay. That's okay, because it was actually in Article 12. See, Article 13 happened to be the articles that, you know, covered the amendments, right? And so let me open it up again. And if I go to Article 12, it was right above that. Where do you find 9? Because I remember they were talking 9 states. And so, and it says, but if they cannot agree, Congress shall name 3 persons out of each party, alternately strike out 1, the petitioners begin until the number shall be reduced to 13, and from that number not less than 7, nor more than 9. Oops, no, that's not the one I'm looking for. Here it is. It's actually in 10, and it's in 11. The Committee of States, or any nine of them, shall be authorized to execute in the recess of Congress such powers of the Congress. So they're basically saying that there's this little superpower of nine that can actually do things. And the nine states shall from time to time think expedient to vest them with provided that no power be delegated to the said committee for the exercise of the Articles of Confederation, the voice of the nine states in Congress of the United States Assembled requisite. Then it also says that Canada, because they were basically saying that they're going to allow Canada to join the Union if agreed to by nine states.
What happened to that?
And so remember, we kind of brushed over that, but remember you were asking, or we talked about this in private about, you know, the United States actually was soliciting to Canada and Mexico later to join the Union. And right. So it was already evident even before the Constitution, hey, why don't you guys join the Union? But it only required nine states. So this concept of in the Constitution that they said, you know, this can be ratified and effective if nine states ratify.
Okay.
So that's where that number came in, because it was a part of the Articles of Confederation that they were empowering nine states, this majority, that would then permanently change to 3/4. In other words, the amendment process would not require unanimity. It would only require 3/4. So anyway, I went down that rat hole just to kind of point out that even though they were talking about, you know, making this unanimous, what they actually did was they did empower them to do what was adequate for the exigencies of the Union. One of those exigencies was the fact that they could no longer function as a union requiring unanimity. In other words, it only took one bad apple to keep the union from being able to be effective. And they said, we can't allow, you know, it to be unanimous. This is just crazy. And there's one state go ahead.
That's what I thought you meant when you said supermajority.
Yes.
Okay. There was one state that consistently defied unanimity.
Yeah, so technically when I say nine, I was talking about it wasn't a unanimity. It actually was, it was a majority, but it and a supermajority. I just referred to it as a superminority and probably was poor choice of words.
No, actually I liked it because it made sense.
Yeah.
You had one state that could veto the entire will of the rest of the union,
correct. Which that only bodes for a real problem. I mean, if you want to hamstring any organization, tell everybody that they, I mean, it's almost like to deliver a guilty verdict, you have to have 12 jurors agree. Wow.
Well, that's true, isn't it?
It is in many cases, especially in capital offenses. Yeah, which is why it is so hard to get 12 people to agree. Mm-hmm. At least it used to be. Go watch the movie 12 Angry Men. I don't know if you've seen that, but that's an old, I think 1960, right?
It's an old movie. I may have seen it.
Right.
I think I remember seeing that when I was a kid. So right. I may actually look it up again.
Yeah, because it's not easy getting everybody to completely agree. And it was already evident that the unanimity clause was one of the biggest problems they had. Mm-hmm. The only reason they were having this convention is because Rogue Island was being unreasonable. It was that clear. So as we wrap up, you know, this dialogue from the convention, they send off this thing, and then they included this part that they wanted to ensure that they gave this commission or these delegates enough power to basically render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. So now, keeping that in mind, now when we go through these commissions, how did the states choose? Did they choose to swing it more towards New York, or did they choose to swing it more towards the Annapolis, give these people the power to deal, to create a government adequate for the exigencies of the Union? And so,
I've breezed through these combined state acts, and it seems more like they wanted to give the convention the room necessary to meet the needs of the Union.
Right. Okay, so we're going to start with Connecticut. I've got these things in alphabetical order. And okay. So Connecticut actually empowered their delegates on what day?
This is the 17th of May, 1787. So let me ask you a question. They were supposed to meet in May. I think they were actually supposed to have started meeting by this time.
The second Monday. That's actually what it says right there. An act for appointing delegates to meet in a convention of the states to be held at the city of Philadelphia on the second Monday of May instant. Instant. Now. Okay, so... and we have it kind of highlighted, and so we can kind of go through the perfunctuaries, but let's just go through the entire paragraph of the empowerment. So go ahead.
Okay.
Because they identify who the delegates are for Connecticut, and then they go into it.
Okay. Here we go. Connecticut Act electing and empowering delegates. 17 May 1787, an act for appointing delegates to meet in a committee of the states to be held at the city of Philadelphia on the second Monday of May instant. Whereas the Congress of the United States, by their act of the 21st of February 1787, have recommended that on the second Monday of May instant, a convention of delegates who shall have been appointed by the several states be held in Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. There's that language there. Be it enacted by the governor, council, and representatives in general court assembled and by authority of the same, that the Honorable William S. Johnson, Roger Sherman, and Oliver Ellsworth Esquires be, and they hereby are, appointed delegates to attend the said convention, and are requested to proceed to the city of Philadelphia for that purpose without delay, and the said delegates, and in case of sickness or accident, such one or more of them as shall actually attend the said convention is and are hereby authorized and empowered to represent this state therein, and to confer with such delegates appointed by the several states for the purposes mentioned in the said act of Congress, that may be present and duly empowered to act in said convention and to discuss upon such alterations and provisions agreeable to the general principles of republican government as they shall think proper to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. And they are further directed pursuant to the said act of Congress to report such alterations and provisions as may be agreed to by a majority of the United States representation in convention to the Congress of the United States and to the General Assembly of this state.
Okay, so the key line to me is, well, so it's a, there's an emphasis in this long line that may be present and duly empowered to act in said convention and to discuss upon such alterations and provisions agreeable to the general principles of a republican government as they think proper to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the government. In other words, are they specifying specifically how to think? No.
No.
They give them license to think proper for themselves. So we're going into break here. So it's very clear that they gave them an open-ended license as they think proper to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. So go do what you need to do. And go there now because you're late. And we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so am I misinterpreting this license that Connecticut gave these men?
So they
were allowed to think for themselves what they thought would be necessary. Okay, so Delaware is basically coming into this, and so they're a little bit more formal, a little more long-winded, right? So let's look at, you know, what Delaware does. Go ahead and start with, whereas the General Assembly of the state are, and go ahead and read all of this. Now, we want to take particular attention to the green and the blue, but we'll come back to those. So just go ahead and go through the first and second, the introductory paragraph in sections one and two, and then we'll dive into the green and yellow. Go ahead.
Okay. Whereas the General Assembly of this state are fully convinced of the necessity of revising the federal Constitution and adding thereto such further provisions as may render the same more adequate to the exigencies of the Union, and whereas the legislature of Virginia have already passed an act of that Commonwealth appointing and authorizing certain commissioners to meet at the city of Philadelphia in May next, a convention of commissioners or deputies from the different states, and this state being willing and desirous of cooperating with the Commonwealth of Virginia and the other states in the Confederation in so useful a design, Section 1. Be it therefore enacted by the General Assembly of Delaware that George Reed, Gunning Bedford, John Dickinson, Richard Bassett, and Jacob Broom Esquires are hereby appointed deputies from this state to meet in the convention of the deputies of other states to be held at the city of Philadelphia on the second day of May next, and the said George Reed, Gunning Bedford, John Dickinson, Richard Bassett, and Jacob Broom, Esquires, or any three of them, are hereby constituted and appointed deputies from this state with powers to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by the other states to assemble in the said convention at the city aforesaid and to join with them in devising, deliberating on, and discussing such alterations and further provisions as may be necessary to render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of the Union, and in reporting such act or acts for that purpose to Congress of to the United States in Congress assembled, as when agreed to by them and duly confirmed by the several states, may effectively provide for the same, so always and provided that such alterations or further provisions or any of them do not extend to that part of the fifth article of the Confederation of the said states, finally ratified on the first day of March in the year 1781, which declares that, quote, in determining questions in the United States and Congress assembled, each state shall have one vote, end quote. Section 2, and be it enacted that in case any of the said deputies hereby nominated shall happen to die or to resign his or their appointment, the president or commander-in-chief with the advice of the Privy Council in the recess of the General Assembly is hereby authorized to supply such vacancies. Signed by order of the House of Assembly, John Cook, Speaker. Signed in order of the Council, George Craighead, Speaker. Passed at Dover, February 3rd, 1787.
Okay, so it's interesting because Delaware was one of the few states that actually had a caveat. Now, clearly, and it's interesting that it was consistently misspelling federal, right?
Right.
But anyway, the green part, which is emphasizing what they're empowering them to do, are hereby constituted and appointed deputies from this state. And then here's the initial emphasis, and the big emphasis comes after this, with powers to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by other states to assemble in the said convention at the city aforesaid. And then here's the big important stuff. And to join with them in devising, deliberating on, and discussing such alterations and further provisions as may be necessary to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the union. In other words, go do what you think is best. And right. Then they have this caveat. And it says that such alterations on further provisions of any of them do not extend to that part of the fifth article of the Confederation of the said states finally ratified on the first day of March in the year 1781, which declares that, quote, in determining questions in the United States in Congress assembled, each state shall have one vote. Now, that kind of hamstrung them. They had to have something that came back that in Congress they had this, you know, this one, you know, equal representation.
Right.
Right? They wanted – why was this so hard? Or actually, we talked about this in detail.
This is an easy one. Delaware is the – it is still the smallest state.
I know, and Rhode Island is the smallest state, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. Delaware is one of the smaller states.
Right, yeah, okay.
Okay, and so what they're concerned about is being overrun by representation in the large state.
So did the federal – so let me ask you this. Did this new design of the federal government meet this requirement for them?
Absolutely.
How? Because it was the Senate where they represented that. Yes, correct.
In the Senate. Yes. The Senate represented the states. The House represented the people.
I'm sorry. I lost control of myself. But so to be clear, during the convention, you know, the Delaware kept on, you know, no, we won't have any part of this. We're not going to have any part of this. And they were literally asked, you know, why is it that you won't allow government to be apportioned by the people? And this is what they said. We don't trust you big states. We don't trust you.
And these delegates held true to their commission.
Absolutely they did. Absolutely. And it wasn't until the Sherman Compromise or the Connecticut Compromise where, you know, Roger Sherman actually offered a way forward to give Delaware what they needed so that, you know, you had this ability to, you know, withstand bad, you know, bad laws coming out of Congress because it still had to pass through the Senate where all the states had equal vote.
Correct.
The brilliance in this design.
You're right. It was a brilliant plan. They didn't see this coming, by the way. Okay, this, I mean, when they came to the convention, they didn't know what they were going to end up with.
Right.
And this concern by Delaware drove the direction of representation by states. You know, what we wound up with was like nothing that had ever been done before.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, okay, so now we have two states with one with a caveat, but obviously, both states gave their delegates the license and liberty to do what they felt necessary to create or render the federal constitution capable of dealing with the exigencies of the union.
Okay.
And I think, as far as I'm concerned, what they came home with exceeded expectations.
Okay.
Okay, so now so Georgia.
This is Georgia.
Yeah, Georgia.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Act electing and empowering delegates, 10 February 1787, and ordinance for the appointment of deputies from this state for the purpose of revising the federal constitution. Be it ordained by the representatives of the freemen of the state of Georgia in General Assembly met, and by the authority of the same, that William Few, Abraham Baldwin, William Pierce, George Walton, William Houston, and Nathaniel Pendleton Esquires, and they are hereby appointed commissioners, who or any two or more of them are hereby authorized as deputies from this state to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by other states to assemble in convention in Philadelphia and to join with them in dividing and discussing all such alterations and further provisions as may be necessary to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the union, and in reporting such an act for that purpose to the United States and Congress assembled, as when agreed to by them and duly confirmed by the several states, will effectually provide for the same. In case of the death of any of the said deputies or of their declining their appointments, the executive are hereby authorized to supply such vacancies. So, you know, when I've seen these before, but why it puzzled me why they used this same verbiage, adequate to the exigencies of the union. Well, I hadn't seen the Annapolis report before.
Right.
And so that's why all this language is the same. And when they're saying this, they're not saying we're going to hold on to the articles. Because that's why they're meeting. They knew they were defective.
Well, you could clearly see that the Continental Congress didn't embrace the New York proposition. They Correct. Basically wanted to make sure that this one convention would get it done. Because anybody would know that if you didn't empower the convention to get it done, then you've got then you're years further away from getting where you need to be.
I think they knew they didn't have years.
Yeah, well, yeah. Most of the men who understood the problems of the union, but many of the people, I should say, like Virginia, New York, many of those cabals, they didn't care. As a matter of fact, Massachusetts was very clear. The anti-federalist in Massachusetts said, we don't care. Let these other states ratify it. We can survive without them.
Yeah. Okay.
And where were they when they were actually basically being harangued and beaten, you know, by the iron fist of the British crown? I mean, they were it was happening in Massachusetts for the... They were calling for us to come to their aid.
Oh, you mean they weren't taking care of themselves?
No, no. I mean, when Washington went up there, he brought the Continental Army, you know, the federalized militia, to basically go up there to help basically, you know, get the British out of Back Bay and out of that part of Massachusetts. And, you know, they... In a way, they succeeded. They had a victory, but they ended up having to, you know, I'll just say cut bait, because they ended up, this was the first time Washington really experienced a miracle, because he had the inevitable fog, you know, basically create this cover for him to escape, as the British thought that they had him surrounded, just like with New York. And lo and behold, you know, when the fog cleared, there he was, you know, there was Washington, you know, off and away, and they go, "Why, he escaped. How'd that happen?" You know, and right. You would have thunk that, you know, the British leadership would have gone, you know, clearly the divine hand is protecting these people.
You know, I think some years later, I think one of their generals did say something like that. Okay, I don't remember. I've read it. I just don't remember where to find it. But I think that there was an admission, you know, later on. So that's interesting. So we're going to Massachusetts now, right?
Okay, going into Massachusetts. That is correct.
House Resolution of 7 March repealing.
Okay, so Paul, I think Paul, hold on a minute, because you're kind of cutting up and your words are getting lost. So let me go ahead and basically dive into this. So the very first, you know, order is a repeal of what happened in February, and so whereas they go into the Senate amendment of the House, and so what we're going to find is the highlighted part is, and this happened on the 9th of March, and it is further resolved that the said delegates on the part of this Commonwealth be and are hereby instructed not to accede to any alterations or additions that may be proposed to be made in the present Articles of Confederation, which may appear to them not to consist with the true Republican spirit and genius of the said Confederation, and particularly that they by no means interfere with the fifth of the said articles, which provides, quote, for the annual election of delegates in Congress with a power reserved to each state to recall its delegates or any of them within the year and to send others in their stead for the remainder of the year. In other words, what they wanted in the fifth article that they wouldn't touch would basically, you know, allow them to recall their representatives, you know, during the year of that session, and which also provides that no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years of any term of six. So in other words, they wanted these term limits that were in the Articles of Confederation as well, or being a delegate shall be capable of holding any office under the United States or which or any other for his benefit receive salary, fees, or emoluments of any kind. So they basically said, we don't want you to move forward with doing anything that basically is going to touch any of these things. But more importantly, Massachusetts was the only one that really had these reservations that they did not want their delegates to basically agree to, basically, it says, accede to any alterations or additions that may be proposed to the made and the present Articles of Confederation, which may appear to them not consistent with the true Republican and particularly these very specific things. So in other words, they were hamstrung to make sure that these very specific things they would be able to do, have term limits and be able to recall their delegates if they're not happy with them.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And they do say actually above this that it says right here, it is expedient that on the second Monday in May, in the next convention of the delegates who shall be appointed by the several states to be held at Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of the revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress, the several legislatures, such alterations of provisions therein as shall, when agreed in Congress, confirmed by then, render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and preservation of the union, close quote. So in other words, they were basically giving them license, but they hamstrung them with that amendment of the 9th of March. So I wanted to basically point out that there were some very specific things. So the question is, did they fulfill this caveat that these things would be preserved?
The Massachusetts delegates may have held to their limits, but no. Okay, I mean, for the annual, they didn't impose these limits to the delegates of Congress.
Well, so right. So hold on. So actually, there's only one thing that they fell short on. So the three things that they're asking them, because they wanted to be able to recall their appointees or delegates, that can be done at any point in time. States can recall them. The Constitution does not hinder a state from recalling their representatives or senators.
Okay.
Okay. The one thing is that they wanted the term limits in the Articles of Confederation to be maintained. That's the one thing that was not injected into the Constitution, that there would be term limits. And the argument for that is that's a state issue. If you want to have a term limits, then don't elect these guys. But we don't. And okay. So bottom line, the states, you know, they had the ability not to elect. But here's the proof in the pudding. If you can't, and I want to say this so that you understand why this is so important, because the parties have really absconded and are controlling our government today, the Republicans and Democrats. And so the Constitution does not allow for term limits. Can a state impose term limits to a representative or a senator?
I'm not sure it can.
No, it can't. It cannot. It cannot alter the eligibility of a person to serve. So how is it that the parties could actually invoke primaries and take away somebody from being able to be on the general election? It's the same thing, isn't it? It's a process that takes away a person from being able to become a, and I admit that if you want to be a candidate to be representing a very specific party and the party wants to have a primary, then that's fine. But the party should pay for their primary.
Agreed.
And everybody else goes on the ticket. The party itself will boil it down so that you only vote for one Republican and one Democrat, but everybody else, it's fair game. And when you look at the debates and the way they have full control, it's always just the primary parties. How is it that we're being represented when the parties have basically closed out any other dialogue? I mean, go ahead.
You know, the other thing that's important to understand is that if you look at registered voters, and I do, a large contingent of registered voters are not affiliated with any party. So how can we suppose for a private organization to actually represent unaffiliated voters? Does that make sense?
So I'm actually diving into this. It's going to be included in Why Counties Matter Most, because bottom line, the counties have to actually start dealing with and addressing the fact that the parties have locked down the ability for the counties and for we the people to obtain, you know, adequate representation.
Right.
And so, you know, what makes a person a party member? Are you a party member because you vote a particular way? Because when we look at the dialogue, they count how many votes for the Republicans and how many votes for the Democrats, and that's how they determine party affiliation. That's wrong. All that does is it identifies, and we've grown down a rat hole here, folks, but all that does is it identifies how many people are buying the Democrat and Republican product. That's all. In other words, if you go into Walmart and you go into Nordstrom's or Neiman Marcus or whatever, and you know, you say, okay, well, this is how many people these stores represent. Well, no, that's just how many people are actually buying their crap.
Right.
That's all it is. When you really look at how many people are directly affiliated to Walmart, you have to look at how many employees there are, how many people are engaged in the process of operating. And that's when you look at the parties and you find people that become PCOs, you will find, folks, that the party is everybody's more than welcome, but the party actually doesn't want everybody. They don't want a bunch of people fighting for the precinct committee officer and all of that. They want to keep it small so they can control it all.
Mm-hmm.
That's the adage. Keep it small, keep it all. And so, what we're really dealing with is a very small elite group of people who actually get to choose who your electors will be, and we're blindly buying into this. And so there's been some conversation of what it would take, and actually a huge ardent supporter and producer for the show is trying to pursue how do we get electors onto the ballot instead of actually allowing the parties to choose the electors. What would happen if you, the people in your congressional district, chose your elector and removed the president's names, and we actually followed the Constitution and chose electors? Now, there's so many people that are just scratching their head. Why would we do that? Why don't we just vote for president? Why don't we have a popular vote? Because the Constitution doesn't allow it.
Correct.
No. I mean, this is why I keep going back and forth. Does the Constitution allow the state legislature to basically allow a winner take all, you know, go into the Senate and go into the House of Representatives? In other words, okay, well, the Democrats had the best out turnout for the vote this year. So everybody that's going to be represented for out of the state of will all be represented by the Democrats. In other words, even though you voted for a Republican, you don't get to have your Republican representation.
Sure. So the state determines to disenfranchise those electoral votes.
Yes, correct. I mean, so this is why this is really important, because people really need to understand, you know, how we've been led to believe that the parties are much bigger than they really are. They're not. These are elite boys clubs. And I don't mean to seem sexist by calling it that, but I think everybody understands that this is where, you know, there's a small trough and there's a lot of power controlled by a very few amount of people. And this is how it has become so corrupt. And why they do not care about complying to the Constitution. Why should they want to comply to the Constitution? They'd lose control. If we actually started voting for electors, they would absolutely lose control. They can't have that. The globalists won't allow it. Folks, we have to start standing up. We have to start demanding compliance of the Constitution. But anyway, like I said, we just went down a rat hole, and I kind of just shot the last of this hour. So I apologize, Paul. Any comments? We got about half a minute left before we conclude, and then tomorrow we'll pick it up with Maryland. Any comments?
No, I think we'll. I am ready for. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can now. You were getting all staticky. Okay. There was a problem with the connection, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to the next ones. We're out of time, but thanks for today.
No.
I answered a lot of questions.
Yeah. And I think the conclusion is so far that we've found two states that had caveats, but all of the states empowered them to be basically go and do what you think's necessary. So with that.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah, so with that, folks, hopefully your takeaway is to start realizing that, you know, the cabals, they moved. They moved out of the states, and they started diving into parties because that's how they started operating. And Washington warned us of the parties, and all the framers knew the evils of the party, or the party system and factions, and how destructive they are. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.